offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of the Afternoon Satsang. And we are going back to the book Conversations with Bhagwan Shri Sathya Sai Baba, where Dr. Hislop, one of the ardent devotees of Swami from the United States, has documented the conversations that he has had with Swami and conversations that he has been witness to. The last time around, we came across a very beautiful part where there is a discussion on the chaos and disharmony in the world, and pretty much talking about what Swami would refer to in his discourses as the qualities of the Kali Yuga. And there Swami said that it is purely because of the devotion of the devotees and the spiritual ones that the world is still able to get along and put up with the atrocities that happen on the surface of the earth. And that was a part we were talking about, and we also made a reference to Swami talking about that even to other devotees. And the point where we took a break is where clearly there is a maybe even a change of date in which the recording is happening, because we at this point Dr. Hislop documents a conversation or a session that Swami had with the devotees from the Jewish community who were there in the ashram at that point in time. So Swami must have given them a separate session in the interview room, so he also had an opportunity to be a part of that. So that's the point where, that is the part that we're going to go through today. Some of the discussions are very specific to the community, but as always, some things that Swami says are so very beautiful and universal that it applies to all of us. But before we come to all of that, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam, Arvind.
Sairam Prem, and Sairam to all our listeners. As Prem introduced, today we will be beginning with Swami talking to Jewish devotees. It's very interesting because, as we have seen even in the later years, whenever people would come to Swami as a group, Swami would call them into the bhajan hall and talk to them as a group. So here Swami is speaking to the Jewish devotees along with a few others, and without further ado, let me dive directly into what Dr. Hislop has recorded. He writes, "A request was made to Baba that he deliver a discourse directly to the Jewish people, a unique, ancient and powerful minority in the society of the world. The occasion for a major discourse was not at hand, but Baba graciously called all the Jewish devotees presently in the ashram for an interview and included a few additional people, of whom I was one, fortunately indeed for me. Unhappily, I was unable to keep up with the rapid exchange of questions and answers and could not remember afterwards, largely I think because of my unfamiliarity with the subject matter. I did manage to take a few notes and believe it worthwhile to make them a part of this book. Prior to the questions and answers, Baba made a few comments." So after that, he has just recorded whatever he is able to remember, and he says that, "I'm not able to remember much because of my unfamiliarity with the religion, that is the Jewish religion. Those who aren't very familiar often mistake the Jewish religion and the Christian religion. Though both have had similar origins, the way they have grown is quite different. Their beliefs, their holidays, their feast days, their fast days, everything is diametrically opposite, and we shall see more about that as the discussion continues. But I was really interesting to see how he has described the Jewish people as unique, ancient and a powerful minority. Every word I think he has measured and put. The reason is, the reason why they are being called powerful is probably because if we have a look at the world today, some of the top people in the scientific field, in technological fields, in education, in social sciences,
business,
yes, some of the most richest and most influential people, all of them come from this community. But they are a minority because of the Holocaust that happened during the Second World War, where they were targeted and persecuted on a massive world scale. And of course, with the country of Israel coming into being in 1948, they were all, that is their promised land, and even that, you know, that country of Israel itself, if we see how it is today, it's fascinating to say the least, to see how it has grown into, you know, if I may be allowed a brief digression, just to show how this community has remained bonded and strong despite so much that they have faced. In 1948, I think they were given their own land per se, when the British vacated that area and divided the whole region into two parts, one being given to the Jews as their country, which they called Israel, the other being given to the Palestinian people, who were basically the Arabs in that region. What happened was Israel agreed for their part, but Palestine wasn't happy with that kind of division. And therefore, while Israel consolidated into a country quickly, the rest of it was not yet made. It was not part of any country. And the neighboring country, Jordan, annexed off Palestine because they had to give backing to that. And there was a constant conflict. And as a result of that conflict, you know, there was a war which resulted in Israel capturing large swaths of land across. Even Palestine was taken over. And even to the south, I think, before where the Asian continent joins the African continent, that whole region, that whole swath of land was captured. But Israel was only wanting to defend its own rights and territory, and was not wanting to conquer any land, so it gave back the land to the south. But when it came to the Palestinian region, it was very difficult because the aggressor country here was Jordan, and Israel was not wanting to give back that piece of land to Jordan. And if it's not giving back that piece of land, what does it do with it? It was also not ready to give Israeli citizenship to all the residents there. So that is what is the conflict about, and that conflicted piece of land continues to remain there. In the meanwhile, because it is the holiest of holy places for the Jews, you know, there are two areas, one being Jerusalem, the other, I forget the name. Both these are extremely holy for the Jews, as well as the Christians, as well as for the Muslims. So since it is very holy for them, and they are a very, very religious people, a lot of people from Israel have gone and settled into these areas. And so now, though the land is supposed to have been Palestine, it is having about 40-45% of Jews settled there, and the conflict is going on. I'm just giving this to say that they have had a lot of difficulty. Even now that continues, and yes, there are people speaking on both sides of the debate, but this community, despite all these odds, have really turned out trumps in terms of winning Nobel Prizes, winning worldwide recognition, making contributions, everything. And I think that's why he talks of them as a unique, ancient, yet powerful minority.
Right, and I think from the point of view of Swami's interactions, this might be pretty unique. I don't think Swami has ever called one community like that and spoken to them. Mm. And this also might be a means of Swami recognizing that there's a good number of them here and Swami is speaking to them. And I think there was also that conversation earlier about Swami, just some time ago, of Swami including the Star of David, the symbol of Jewish faith, in the Sanatan Dharma, and I'm sorry, in the Sarvadharma symbol.
And, for use in the worldwide organization.
And even there, Swami had made the statement, isn't the Christian and the Jewish faith both represented by the cross? And he said, no, Swami, we don't. They're pretty unique in their ways. So when you said that a lot of people don't look at the Jewish faith as being separate, it's as you said, because of the very similar origins. Old Testament, and they kind of have a few common messiahs, if you could put it that way, starting from Moses and Abraham. And the rest. So in that sense, yes, they're different, and many times when you look at it in a conflict in many places around the world today, be it South Korea, North Korea, be it India and Pakistan, it's really, in a sense, fascinating and saddening at the same time. That people who share roots which are so ancient and in so many ways that are common find so many reasons to have conflict with each other. And the Jewish and the rest of Christianity or Islam is a sign for that. You have so much in common, you have so much belief also in common, but yet we dwell on those differences and we kind of fight over it. as the conversation proceeds, we'll see that Swami also makes a reference to that, that it's a time where we live in brotherhood rather than looking at differences.
I think, as you said, it's about whether we choose to see the glass half full or half empty, whether we choose to see the unifying factors and remain united, or we see the differences and create diversity in unity. You know, it's totally left to our perspective, and I think that is what Swami is emphasizing more about rather than just the history. So Swami begins, Swami says, I mean, this is, I think, Dr. Hislop's summary of what Swami said that day. Swami says, the great scriptures of mankind came into being through sound, the word of God. This is fully true of the ancient Jewish religion. It was the word of God. Over the centuries, however, man has made changes in the Bible, and present misunderstandings are due to these man-made changes. In the early days, there were differences between the Jews and the Christians, but they are not appropriate today. Today, the standard should be the brotherhood of man, based on the divine love of God for all mankind. Each religion should follow that which is its own, and not follow a path which belongs to others, but which is not its own. Follow your own tradition, but do not hate others. Be broad-minded, as are the followers of Sai. You know, in that summary, there are some very interesting statements. One being that, be broad-minded as are the followers of Sai. It's almost like a definition of a follower of Sai. If you are a follower of Sai, you have to be broad-minded. If you're narrow-minded, then I think only in name we are calling ourselves as Sai devotees. The other thing is, Swami says that there were differences between the Jews and Christians when it started off, but those differences are not relevant today. And yet, there is so much of a divide. Not just, in this case, it's Jews and Christians, but across every religions, you know, the way it originated, the way something started in those times, there might have been some differences, but today, they are not relevant at all. In fact, I'm again tempted to go back to what I was saying as the Israeli-Palestine conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to watch a documentary where people have actually traveled, where a group of reporters have traveled and spoken to people, the Israeli people settling in Palestine. They have not managed to speak to the Palestine people. But when they spoke to the Israeli people, you know, when I'm saying this in the context of Swami saying what was relevant is no longer relevant now, because though some of them say this is our holy land, how can we give it up? That's why the moment it was not belonging to any country, it was like a conflict area, we decided to come here and settle. But now what has happened is, as Israeli people have settled there, Israel feel that it has to take care of its citizens, so it's starting to build infrastructure, you know, and infrastructure being built, roads being built, all of that makes sense only when there is economies of scale, you know. The more the number of people benefited, more advantages are those projects.
Right.
So, because of that, they have started incentivizing people to settle in Palestine. So much so that now, a majority of the Israeli settlers in that land, you know, the West Bank as they call. I was also wondering why is it called the West Bank, because it's on the eastern side of Israel. But it happens to be on the western bank of the river Jordan. Mm-hmm. That's why it's called West Bank. So now the majority of the people settling in West Bank are settling there because they say that the facilities are better here, cost of living is cheaper here, it's beautiful, and yeah, it is also our holy land. So it's no longer, I mean, the reason for which the shift started no longer holds relevance so much today. Because most of the people are saying, it's not anything about religion, it's just that it's all good here. So too, it has happened across many other things like that, where Swami says that the difference between Jews and Christians, maybe it was there. Now they are not relevant in that sense because they have the same common origin. And that is also probably the reason why, you know, in the Sarvadharma symbol, Swami felt that the cross represents, Swami asked Hislop, doesn't it represent? Because in India, definitely, I, speaking for myself, I can say that I felt it the same. Both of them have the Old Testament. Yeah, okay. So one of them followed the older leader, one of them following the later leader. That is what I felt. But it is different. So that is what Swami is saying. Finally, what is most important, Swami says, is to be broad-minded and live with the motto of brotherhood of man and fatherhood of God.
And also Swami makes a reference to one of the most important verses from the Bible itself, I think. Some form of this is available even in the Jewish books, I'm sure, where Swami speaks about how God was in the beginning only a word. And I think that there's one of the first verses in the Bible.
The word Gospel was with John, God, the word was God.
In the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. Right? It's the first verse, I think, first or second verse in the book of John. So Swami makes a reference to that, and this is something which again, as I said, is not only similar to what is said in the Jewish tradition, but even in the Vedantic tradition, we say that Shabda Brahmamayi, Swami would say, that God is known as sound in the beginning. So that's what Swami starts with, and Swami says that there is no relevance for these differences. In fact, quite interestingly, just a few days back, I was reading there was an article about the kind of differences that was there in the Vedantic school. You know, today when we read a discourse or when you give a talk, we actually very effortlessly go from concepts of Vishishta Advaita, Advaita and Sankhya Yoga.
Across schools.
Right, across schools. And we have no problem with that because we actually don't realize which belongs to what. You know,
is that good or bad, I mean?
Right, I really don't know. I think in a sense it is good, because we are looking at it in the form of a wholesome understanding and a wholesome way to progress in our, in our grasp of what Swami is trying to convey.
Mm.
But in the past, it was very strictly, you know, this was Charvarka and this was Sankhya, and there was no overlap between the two. And people were, you know, known to debate for hours together on the basis of tarka, what they would call the art of argumentation. But today it's not that way at all. In fact, even if you read any of Swami's discourses, it's very difficult to say that Swami is Advaita or Vishishta Advaita or something like that, because it really doesn't matter. It is only about understanding, and more or less it becomes what appeals to you at that point in time, what enhances your ability to think straight, act straight. I think it comes down to that. And I think in many ways that's what Swami is saying, that there is no difference. There is so much of unity in all of this that can be celebrated, and that's in a sense what Swami is saying. Today the standard should be the brotherhood of man based on the divine love of God for all mankind.
Going ahead, actually Swami says, we already said that, Swami is saying that nothing wrong in following your tradition, but please don't hate others. Yeah. So that is important. Then Swami says the Bible, the Quran, the Vedas, the Granth, all represent the same creation. Just now, Prem, I think you referred to that. For us, for anybody, in the beginning, there was sound. You know, we say it is Omkara. And that's interesting, because all these religions, you know, Islam, Christianity and Jewish, are called Abrahamic religions because they derive from Abraham. In fact, Father Abraham, I remember studying in a Christian missionary school,
mm-hmm.
in for my first grade to fourth grade, and there was this song, Father Abraham had many sons had Father Abraham, meaning to say that Abraham had many sons, but so many consider him as Father Abraham. And two of his sons are very famous. One of them is Isaac and the other is Ishmael, and Ishmael's lineage and continuity is what finally gives rise to the followers of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And on Isaac's side, we have both the genesis of Judaism and Christianity. So, when Swami says the Bible, the Quran, the Vedas, the Granth, all are one, it's amazing, because I was thinking that possibly the Abrahamic religions have a common origin. But with Shabda or sound being brought in, I think at the subtlest level, if we see, all are one.
Right. And then I think thereafter, he documents a conversation that happens where people ask questions and...
But before that, there is one small, all were following the voice of God, Swami says.
Right.
Swami says, all were following the voice of God. All arose from the whisper of God, which in the pure minds of the hearers flowered into 8 sounds, 8 letters. And from all this, all words evolved. The 8 sounds were the vowels and consonants of language. The foundation of the Jewish religion is precisely the same as that of the Vedas, the breath of God. cognized by the pure attention of the ancient seers, was heard as 8 sounds, and these sounds have been given names. And Dr. Hislop records that Baba here pronounced each of these 8 primeval sounds, but I could not write them down.
Right. So, this is, I think, somewhere Swami had spoken about it. I was looking up for it. I couldn't find it. Apparently, when Swami speaks about Vedas, also Swami speaks of these 8 sounds. And
I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but I think it might possibly be A, E, U, K, Ch, T, T, P.
Yeah.
Because all the other consonants are formed, all the other vowels are formed as a combination of A, E, U. For example, A and E becomes A, A and U becomes O, A and U becomes AU, all that way. So I don't know. I'm just guessing because there are also 8 exactly. This is how it is. And K, Ch, T, T, P are the basic consonants. They are divided based on where the sound is produced from. For example, K is produced from the throat. Ch is produced from the back of the tongue touching the back of the
palate.
And T is produced from the tip of the tongue touching the top of the palate. T is produced by tip of tongue touching the teeth. And P with the lips. So this is what I assume might possibly be the 8 sounds. I might be wrong, but
I think it is right. But each one of those has a certain name which Swami uses. I think even in Telugu and some of the South Indian languages, it is there. So in one of the discourses, Swami says this, and I really could not find that, because whenever Swami would speak about the Veda, Swami would say that it all started with pranava and panava, and then you have these 8 sounds, and then you have the Vedas, and then the rest of the languages come forth from there. So I think that's what Swami is saying here, and in that sense, this is what connects even Judaism with the Vedic religion, as Swami puts it here. And after this, the conversation starts, right? We'll go into that, where again, this is noted down from Hislop's memory, as he has said right in the beginning itself.
And it looks like Swami again made that point there, because Hislop makes a quick jotting there, writing that the Sai symbol of 5 religions represents the 5 major religions found in India. For the West, the Jewish star may be added as the 6th representation in the Sai symbol. So I think Swami clearly announced it.
Right.
A few days back it was a discussion, and today Swami has announced it to all the Jewish devotees.
Right. So one of the questions the people over there ask is, was Jesus the Messiah of the Jews? And Swami says, no, he did not represent the ancient Jewish tradition. He represented the factor of change. It's a very interesting answer there. And
It is also, when you check up, that is one of the major differences between Jews and Christians, because Jews don't consider Jesus as a Messiah.
Right.
They don't celebrate Easter. They don't celebrate Christmas. Anything related to the form of Jesus, and that's because like the other Abrahamic religion, Islam, the Jews don't believe that God can have a human form. So they only believe in prophets, and Moses is the prophet, and I think possibly that's why these Jews are asking Swami also, because finally this is the ultimate authority. So they're asking, was Jesus the Messiah of the Jews? And Swami says, no, he did not represent the ancient Jewish tradition. He represents the factor of change. So there is a major change that happens at that time. And the next question is very interesting, more than the question, the answer, because they say, in the Bible, it says that Jews are God's chosen people. And Swami says, all people are created by God. All are his chosen people. This is again, as this point has registered in my mind, I keep seeing it again and again in every interaction. The fact that people, all of us, we love exclusivity. But Swami is always inclusive. Even in our relationship with Swami, we try to find some exclusivity. We are students. We are supposed to be the Vanaras or the Gopikas of yore. Or I'm a staff. Or I'm an office bearer. Or something or the other. I want something special. I want a badge. But Swami is not. Swami says, all are one. All are one, my dear son. Be alike to everyone. And again, that aspect is seen even in this conversation, where they're asking whether Jews are chosen people. Swami says, no, all are chosen people.
Right. And both the answers that Swami had given in the previous one, Swami did not say that he's not the Messiah of the Jewish tradition or the Jewish beliefs. Mm. He says he kind of, Jesus was the Messiah of change. So it almost suggests that, again, as Swami is going to say again later, it is not like following that tradition does not take you to the goal, or following this change tradition is what is important. It probably represents that there were a certain set of people who kind of looked forward to change or looked forward to a reformation in what was being practiced at that point. And Jesus represented that need for change in a sense, where Swami says he was Messiah for a change in what was being practiced then. Similarly, when Swami answers the next question, it is not like, you know, they belong to God, or these were special. It was not the Christians were special, or the Jews were special. I mean, as Swami would say in one of the sentences, Swami would say in Sanskrit, "Munde munde matir bhinna," right? Swami would say that every mind is different, and you need somebody who kind of channelizes and who is able to give right direction to a changed perspective in mind. And more or less, many saints and messiahs whom we come across are those people. Even in India, you will always find that for a certain period, you had the caste system which was progressing, and it had a certain relevance. But at a certain point, it was going out of relevance, and you had a certain set of people coming and giving direction to that frustration and change. Right? It is not that being is bad or not being is bad, or, you know, the change is good. You just need the right kind of direction for that energies which is expressing itself as frustration. And in a way, I think all the messiahs and the men of God whom we speak of in history are representation of that.
Absolutely. So, in fact, I was just thinking, Swami says all of us are so unique and special. He says you are God, you know, in that way. But we are looking out for exclusivity in the external world. And that's why I think we end up comparing ourselves based on wealth or relationships or physical proximity to Swami. You know, I don't think we ever feel that, hey, this person is so humble, he's following so much, let me become more humble than him. We don't. We don't, in a sense, compete in those subtle values. Possibly also because once we start getting those subtle values imbibed in us, this need to compete and prove ourselves better goes away. We never do that. And all the competition and intensity is only on the externals, which Swami is keen on eradicating. The next question is, what is the significance of Hitler? And Swami says, Hitler's actions were activated by ego and power. Meaning, I think Hitler is a kind of example or representation to show what happens when ego and power go into the head or go out of hand. So Swami says that is what is the significance of Hitler. And the next question is, for what reasons have the Jews been persecuted? And Swami says, for every event there is a cause, there is a reason. Doesn't dilate further on it. Instead, Swami says, Sai acts only for love, for the benefit of others. He has no desires, he has no selfish interest. It's very evident that Swami doesn't want to say anything further than that, that for everything there is a cause, but there is one causeless, that is the Lord. His love is causeless, no reason for love, no season for love. I remember this was the definition Swami himself gave when in a Western devotee in audience interview room, when they asked Swami, who are you? Swami defined who he is by singing this song. Love is my form, truth is my breath, bliss is my food, my life is my message, expansion is my life, no reason for love, no season for love. The only causeless entity is the Lord. So though the question was about why the Jews have been persecuted, the answer that Swami gives and the message that he wants to drill down is, everything that you see has a cause, has an effect, and it's all, you know, in that karmic cycle. The only thing that is beyond, that is where you should focus on, is the causeless one, that is Swami.
Right, and very important, these two questions that Swami answers. In fact, whenever Swami speaks about some of the tyrants in history, be it Ravana or Hiranyakashipu or Duryodhana, Swami will invariably bring it down to some very basic, one of the six enemies or Arshadvarkas, as you see. I mean, if you really see it, when you talk of somebody like Hitler, you want some kind of a grand reason for his being, if you really see. For that matter, even Ravana, you want to see some history behind it, or he was, at least you have stories of Jaya and Vijaya, or some kind of a grand reason behind somebody as cruel as that to exist, in the world. But finally, when you do the analysis, Swami says it comes down to this. He was actually suffering from ego, he was suffering from lust, he was suffering from greed. And for you and me, that is always the lesson that needs to be learned.
Because when that is magnified.
Right, this is the magnified and unfettered version of the same qualities that are in you. And that's all you need to know, and that's all you need to work on. It doesn't matter who he was or what was his past and what he did. So I think that's what Swami brings it down to every time. Whenever he speaks about Ravana, you'll find this. Swami would say he was great and he was this and he was that, but he could not control his karma. He could not control his ego. Just some time back, somebody sent a very beautiful forward. I don't know how far it's true or whether it's there in any of the scriptures, where it says that, when Rama goes back to Ayodhya, they ask him, Mother Kaushalya comes and asks him, I heard that you killed Ravana. And then Rama replies to that. He says, the great Tapasvi, the great Jnani, the great scholar, the knower of so many kalas, the great devotee of Lord Shiva, he was killed by his own ego. He doesn't say, I killed him or I vanquished him. Finally, it comes down to that. You have any of these qualities that you have not put a check on, you have not transformed. You might not land up as grand, cruel person as Hitler or Ravana, but you will always end up being hurt by that very emotion in you. And I think that's the simple answer that Swami gives and simple lesson that Swami tries to drive. And sometimes this is quite meaningless in the sense of, why did this event happen? Or, is there a combined karmic debt that had to be paid by this community? Sometimes some of these discussions are quite meaningless in that for the personal journey of a spiritual aspirant.
Yes, they only serve as things that arouse our curiosity and we try to satisfy it. But well, curiosity killed the cat, they say. So, going ahead with the conversation, the next question is, God appeared to the Jews as a burning bush. And Swami says, God appears in any form. It's according to his wish, not because of any necessity or limitation. It is his choice. God is formless. He is sound. He can take any form according to his wish. And I think it's just the limitation of language that Swami is saying, he. I don't think Swami is referring to God as being masculine or feminine or any gender types. But in another sense, we have this that the Lord is the only Purusha. So in that sense, when we say positive, negative, masculine, feminine, then only God is masculine, everything else is feminine. So when we consider it in that way, then yes, God is a he. But if we are talking like he and she in the world today, then that's just English that Swami is saying. So it's not that. So Swami is saying it's not any limitation or a necessity that the Lord takes a particular form. It's his will. It's his choice. Can appear in any form. So yes, he appeared as a burning bush to the Jews. And the next question is, so is Sai the Messiah of the Jews? And Sai says, that is not for Sai to say. That must be determined by you. The real Messiah is the totality of good. Sai is not any particular thing. He's everything. Wow. That's an amazing statement. He is everything is not my statement. I'm telling it to the listeners. This is what Swami says. Swami is not any particular thing. He's everything. So in a way, it answers the question also. When they say, is Sai the Messiah of the Jews? Yes, he is the Messiah of the Jews. He's the Messiah for the Christians. He's the Messiah for the Hindus. He's the Messiah for the Muslims. Those who want him to be the Messiah, he's the Messiah for them. Those who don't want him to be the Messiah, he's not the Messiah for them. I'm reminded of what Swami would always say. Yes, anevare ki, yes, anura. No, anevare ki, yes. No, anura. Sai ki sarvam, yes, yes, yes. Meaning, I say yes to those who say yes. And I say no to those who say no. If we look at it, Swami says, I always say yes, yes, yes. But if you tell me yes, you get back a yes. You tell me no and I tell yes, it becomes a no for you. You know, it becomes a yes for your no. So the yes and no is yesulu nolu notu ki kani sai ki sarvam yes yes yes, Swami would say. And sai ki sarvam yes yes yes, when he says SSS also stands for Shri Satya Sai. So Swami would say that God always says yes. Yes and no is left to you. So if you consider a Messiah, yes, I am your Messiah. If you think I am not your Messiah, I am not your Messiah. And that is the answer he gives when they ask whether Sai is a Messiah for the Jews.
Interestingly, you know, the concept of the burning bush, when Moses has the vision of God as a burning bush, he kind of asks that, you know, what am I supposed to say and who are you? And the different ways, I don't know exactly how it's pronounced. He says, I am Yahweh. That's the name the burning bush uses. And he says that, tell the people that Yahweh told me to convey this to you. And the Ten Commandments and the rest we know. Interestingly, the word Yahweh actually means I am, or I am what I am. So there is no, right, there is no name that Lord gives himself. So when Swami very beautifully says here, you know, he just manifested as a burning bush. It's got nothing to really do. Like you have the idea of Lord in Arunachala. He appears as a burning pillar, right? It's like a pillar of light, it's called. Really, if you look at it, there is no meaning of God coming down in that form, or God coming down as any other form with six limbs or Shankha Chakra and all of that. It is just a representation that the mind can relate to. Finally, it comes down to that. And finally, who are you? And you ask Swami very beautifully, that one of the most beautiful conversations where Swami comes and asks the students in the portico on one day, Swami asks, who am I? And when everybody says all kinds of answers, Swami, you're the avatar, Swami, you're Shiva Shakti Swarupa, you're this, you're that. Finally, Swami says, Nenu Nene. Finally, that is the best definition of God. I am what I am, or I am I. And if you look at it, it's always the same. Whether it is Moses who has the vision, or one of the sages who has the vision in their deep meditation, the answer is always that. You know, Tattva Masi, or I am, or Nenu Nene, as Swami said it. So very beautifully Swami answers that question of why a burning bush? Why not a burning bush? Literally, in that sense. But the answer is always Yahweh. You know, I am what I am.
Yeah, I think in India we call it Jehovah.
Right.
Yeah, different.
Exactly. It's the Hebrew, the version word, which gets translated in many ways in the Bible and elsewhere.
With that, whatever Dr. John Hislop has recorded about Swami talking with Jewish devotees comes to an end. The next part is actually in a drive when they're going in a car. So I think we will take that up after a break. It's very interesting, the conversation they have during the drive, as always. But for that, we'll have to wait a few minutes and enjoy this break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back very soon.
Shalom, Jerusalem.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We just completed the portion where Swami spoke to the devotees from the Jewish tradition who were in the ashram. And I think from the conversation or what is going to happen right now, we could say that maybe this conversation happened in Vrindavan, or I don't know whether it is in Parthi. That doesn't clearly say. But,
I think we have just skipped a little portion. There is a conversation now that happens in the car.
Right, I think that is in Vrindavan clearly from what Swami is speaking.
That Gokulam, going to Gokulam.
Right. But this interaction with the Jewish devotees, we are not sure whether it happened in Vrindavan or Parthi. It is not clearly mentioned.
But I think mostly it happened in Vrindavan.
Right. I think it mostly happened in Vrindavan because the remaining conversation happens in Vrindavan clearly.
Also, towards the end, there is a devotee who is called MG, who says that on Wednesday, the Jewish festival of light starts. And it's for 8 days. Can the Jewish devotees have lights burning in Vrindavan?
Right.
So it must have been.
So we're just guessing that the whole event has happened in Vrindavan, the conversation, the interview to the Jewish devotees and whatever is happening after that also.
So now it is Swami to a devotee driver who's saying to the Gokulam. So I wonder if this is also in Vrindavan. While reading it, I just thought there's no Gokulam in Vrindavan. I mean, Gokulam with
actually,
cows as such.
It might be in Vrindavan because the Gokulam, Vrindavan Gokulam was always there from the early 70s, right? The Parthi Gokulam came much later, 1975.
Five. Right. Okay. But the Vrindavan Gokulam is such a small one with just a few cows.
Right. So just driven in the backyard.
And I'm just right now asking whether there is a complex called Gokulam Complex. And there is a Gokulam which is right behind Swami's residence with a few cows.
Gokulam complex is very, very recent. I think 99 or 98.
So that is why I think this doubt came in my head because Swami is telling to the driver to the Gokulam. So this Gokulam is right behind his home.
Right.
Maybe they're going to go somewhere else via the Gokulam.
Possible.
Whatever. The conversation happens. So Swami says to the devotee driver to Gokulam. And yeah. The very fact that it's a devotee driver that Hislop has mentioned, most probably it must be Bangalore. Because in Parthi, Puttaparthi, Swami always had the standard drivers, if we may say so. But in Bangalore, when Swami was in Bangalore, many people have had this blessed opportunity to drive Swami around. And that's why possibly Hislop refers to him as devotee driver. Swami says to the Gokulam. And then Swami tells Hislop, this area is now very busy. The college is here and now there are the fields to the left. There are 60 acres and there is land on the college side also. And Hislop asks, are the lands irrigated? And Swami says, all is under irrigation. Where does the water come from? Hislop asks. We have dug wells. They produce a large volume of water. And Hislop asks, is the water good? Is it fit to drink? Swami says, it is good, sweet water. How deep are the wells, Swami? About 15 to 20 feet deep. And Hislop says, but Swami, that is very shallow. Usually wells need to go below the surface water table to be sweet. Swami says, but Swami located where to dig. And Hislop says, well, that is different. And Swami also adds to what Hislop said by saying, the government experts came to locate wells, but even though they went down 100 feet, no water was found. So this is the conversation, and I think I was predisposed and biased towards Puttaparthi, and that's why I kept building the scenario in my mind as Puttaparthi. But yes, when Swami says there are fields to the left, there are 60 acres, there's land on the college side also, yes, it definitely is a reference to Vrindavan. And Swami is saying that because they have dug where Swami has told to dig, at 15-20 feet, you have found water.
Right, and the conversation continues, I think, where Hislop is saying, Swamiji, I cannot understand how the government does not come to Swami, touch his feet and ask him to run the country. And Swami's answer is quite interesting. Swami says, it is not the government, it is not that the government is unaware of what Swami is doing. They do not think it would be good for Swami to be involved in politics. Swami is kind of giving the benefit of doubt to them, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Nor does Swami wish that. His interest is with his devotees and with what he is now doing. If the government should really know Swami's reality and his power, they would declare him to be a ward of the government, surround him with security, and he would be unable to continue to see the devotees. It is not Swami's wish. With the move of his hand, Swami could have the entire world acknowledge him. But to what end? It would be spectacular only and would accomplish nothing of value. Very profound and very deep answer that Swami gives. One thing is, I think the conversation that just preceded this, where Swami says water was found within 15-20 feet, which is actually enormously miraculous for something like that to happen. And Swami is also saying that the government came and looked for it and they did not find till 100 feet. So Hislop is asking Swami, I mean, this is happening right in front of their eyes. I'm sure the government officials would be aware of it, at least those who came and did the survey, that Swami is able to find the water. Many, many things like this must be happening. And why is it that the government is not acknowledging that Swami is here, and why not just give the reins to Swami and have the government being run peacefully, and at least come and take instructions from Swami, if not anything more. And Swami's answer to that is so very beautiful. I think all of us should be grateful that Swami chose to have things this way. And Swami says, if Swami had really made everyone aware of Swami's divinity, the government would have said that Swami belongs to us and probably deployed the army here, and none of us would have had the opportunity to go anywhere near Swami. And grateful we must be for that.
Absolutely. And another perspective that I felt while reading this was, through this, Swami also is stating that the government is witnessing all this, but they don't have the conviction of Swami's reality. Because that is the reason they're not doing it. And then I was thinking, why go to the government? Look at my own life. Am I convinced that Swami is divinity personified? Then do I offer my all to him? Do I do everything as per what Swami has said? I sometimes don't stick to the path of satya or dharma or shanti or prema, because I feel it's, in quotes, impractical. You know, how often do we tell each other that, yeah, Swami says this, but come on, let's be practical. Let's talk practically. Leave that spirituality aside. Let's think practically. We are, you know, directly stating that spirituality is impractical. What Swami says is impractical. And all of us are guilty of doing this to different measures or extent in our own life. We ourselves are not offering ourselves fully to Swami, but we want everybody else, we want the governments to come and just acknowledge Swami. I think that, for me personally, that was indicated when Swami said this. Swami saying that, you know, because the other day, you know, when I was reading that book, Loving God, there Professor Kasturi records about Burgula Ramakrishna Rao.
Mm.
You know, he was the governor of Kerala, and he pleaded and begged Swami to come to Kerala, and he says that though he's the governor of Kerala, unabashed, without feeling the slightest anything, he would sit only on the floor in Swami's presence. Even, you know, there is a huge setting where they have made a stage where Swami is on the chair, and because he's the governor, he's on equal chair. He just refuses, you know. That kind of, you know, I feel that kind of feeling when you have, because Professor Kasturi again records in that book where Burgula Ramakrishna Rao spoke and said that, you know, whatever I am today is because of Swami. Swami has put me here. If it is Swami's will, I'll be governor, I'll be anything. If it is not, I'll be nothing. My life is Swami. You know, I think once that conviction comes, automatically the result is that total kind of surrender, or whatever thing that comes close to total surrender. But when that conviction is not there, even though you may witness and you may admire and say, wow, this happened, you know. We also think of so many miracles we say, and personal experiences also we think of, and yet we find it so hard to surrender totally. I think it would be impractical to expect the government to come and surrender in that manner.
And in many ways, if you really look at it, and Swami has said this many times in the past, he's saying it even here, the whole idea of an avatar coming down is always for that individual touch and that personal relationship with the devotees. the moment you say government, you're talking of a body, you're talking of a collection of individuals.
Institution.
But it is always with individuals that Swami had his interaction. And we've seen many people in the government as Burugul Ramakrishna Rao, great devotee of Swami. Many, many devotees who kind of acknowledge this, you know, we belong to Swami, and the way they treated their role and responsibility completely changes. Thanks to the lockdown, you know, we are going back to all these old serials which have been coming in Doordarshan, and one of them is this serial on the life of Shri Krishna. So very beautifully, they describe the relationship that the minister of the Mathura court, Akrura, has with Lord Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
It's very beautiful because we know that Swami always refers to Akrura as the devotee representative of the Vandana form of devotion in Navavidha Bhakti. Right? And very, very beautifully they explain why that is so. He's a very righteous minister, and he's looking at everything from the point of view of governance.
Mm.
And when he's told that the Lord is going to come down in the form of a avatar, and he's going to establish dharma, he's always looking at it from that point of view. You know, from, you know, the government will be so much better if run by God, who comes and takes over, and he's going to be the king. And he's thinking of the times of Ramarajya, which will be re-established and all of that. So finally, he comes to Rishi Gargi, right? Gargamuni, right?
Mm.
He is the one who foretells that Lord Krishna is going to come down. And
if I'm not wrong, I think he is the one who even does the namakarna.
Naming, right, namakarna for, because he is the kulaguru for the Yadavas.
Nandas.
So he comes and, you know, Akrura comes and asks him, where is Lord Krishna? And he says, Lord Krishna is in Vrindavan. He is enjoying there with the gopis and gopalas. And so Akrura is not able to place that. He says, you know, there is so much of chaos in the world, and Kamsa is on one side doing all kinds of atrocities, and Jarasandha and all these people, everything is happening in one side. What is Lord Krishna doing?
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't he coming and taking charge of the throne of Mathura? And then very beautiful conversation ensues, and the Rishi tells him he is doing what he has come for, and he is establishing and making people fall in love for him. And that is what an avatar comes for, and everything else happens through that process.
Mm.
The dharma samsthapana that you are worried about happens through this inculcating of, you know, prema samsthapana, literally, inculcating of devotion. And he's saying, you don't worry, he's doing what he has come for.
Mm.
But then Akrura is not able to, you know, understand that. He says, how is that possible? And, you know, there's so much of chaos. He goes back into that. And finally, the point comes where Akrura comes and takes Krishna and Balrama back to Mathura. And he tries all kinds of ways by which to stop this whole thing from happening, because he says that this is the only hope. What will happen if Kamsa gets rid of them? And finally, at one point, Balrama looks at Krishna and says, you know, Krishna, he's a poor fellow. He's so devoted to you. He's so devoted to dharma. I think you should show him who you really are.
Mm.
And then in this journey towards Mathura, at one point, Krishna shows Akrura who he really is. And from then on, the way Akrura functions completely changes, because he says that, what more is there for me? I have to just be a representative of Lord Krishna, and what he tells me I have to do. If he says fight, I have to fight. If he says jump, I have to jump. And that is why that he is given as a example where, you know, you have been doing dharma from the point of your idea of what is to be done. But when you understand that this is God and this is what I need to follow, the way you dispense that same dharma completely changes. You do everything as a form of worship. And I think individually it has happened to many people, even in politics, Indian and Western. And the moment they acknowledge Swami for what he is, not only does their personal life undergoes a transformation, the way they look at their contribution to their country and their role towards the larger society also completely changes in that sense.
It's indeed a great thing that Akrura, from that state, he has gone to a state where the same Krishna is giving him as an example for Vandanam.
Right.
Meaning, because I think he converted his work into worship. Because as such, he didn't do any worship or Vandanam, but his work, the way he did it, itself changed. And I think there is such a beautiful thought in this, that the Lord comes only to establish Prema Rajya. It's not taking Prema Rajya, meaning the kingdom of love, not taking over the government and doing administrative changes. You know, if we look at our own history, I'm saying Indian history, but yeah, history of the world, there have been many wonderfully just and phenomenally good rulers who have established very good systems of governance or whatever. But it lasts for a very little time, you know. After they are gone, you many times see some that the next ruler, the son of that emperor himself, turns out to be the most barbaric and terrible. And this kind of degradation and upgradation, this cycle is seen everywhere. Many times the richest people have children who squander away the wealth, and then there is a person who has come from rags but has built his way to riches. So this kind of cycle keeps continuing, and there is no permanence in that at all. It's also temporary. But at the same time, if we look at the love for Krishna, I think it's as vibrant, as vital, as phenomenal as it was in the Dwapara Yuga. That is why I think Swami doesn't do these things which from our perspective looks like the best way. If I want to bring in a change, yes, just make all the world rulers fall at your feet. So it'll change. But I'm looking only at my lifespan. What about the world after these rulers are gone? What if the president changes and the prime minister changes? We have seen how one president or prime minister changing can turn things totally upside down for the good or for the bad, either way. So that is not at all a permanent solution. In fact, I remember a very beautiful conversation piece that Swami had with a student, with students in Kodaikanal, saying that if I want, like how I change chapati on a tawa while frying, baking chapati, how I turn, like that I can change, but I will not because it's not my system. Swami says that's not my system because that is impermanent. That kind of change doesn't remain. And that's what Swami is saying here also. Swami could have the entire world acknowledge him, but to what end? It would be spectacular only. It would only be spectacular and would accomplish nothing of value. Because Swami's time scales and timelines are like till the end of eternity. Our time scales is possibly next 50 years, that's till when I live, or maybe another 150 years. That's all. I think that is the reason why this whole thing comes. And as you said, the only way to permanently do it is via something that is permanent. And that permanent thing is prema or love. And that's why every avatar comes for prema samsthapana. And as a result of that, dharma samsthapana happens.
And what Swami is saying is here is also very beautiful. He says it would be spectacular only and would accomplish nothing of value. This again, there are so many examples of that. You know, any number of people have come to Swami, and when we read about Swami's early years, the Chitravati days, people who have had all kinds of visions and all kinds of experiences of seeing Swami, Vishwarupa and all of that. But it finally comes down to how is your response to that. Any number of people have been convinced of Swami's divinity, but have everybody used it the same way? It finally comes down to that. And go back to Mahabharata, that you know, the same Vishwarupa was given to Vishnu, was also seen by Sanjaya and was also described to Dhritarashtra. But that did not change anything about his view. If he really felt that, oh God, this is the Lord, you know, I mean, as Swami is saying, it'll only be spectacular. If you are not transformed enough to make use of that vision, you'll only see it as spectacular, and then you'll go back to your own thinking, and that's precisely what happened. And in fact, Lord Krishna even expresses his divinity, or in the sense, displays his divinity when he goes as the messenger much before the war. He does not even work enough to stop a war. Their people are not even wise enough to recognize divinity in front of them and stop a war which is impending. And what more can you say? That how will you expect the government to transform, you know, by the display of Swami's divinity? So very clearly Swami says it'll only be spectacular, but it'll not achieve anything from that point.
At this point in time, another devotee who goes by the initial MG, he speaks here and he takes the conversation in another direction, which is again very interesting. He asks, when will the whole world know about Swami? And Swami replies, even now Sai is known in many countries of the world. This is entirely without precedent. Never before have so many known of the avatar. In the time of Rama, he was known only in the city-state where he lived. And he was naturally venerated there because he was the ruler. Knowledge about Krishna was also very limited. In his earlier days, Krishna was known only in two small villages. And Hislop asks, Is the difference due to changes in communication or the will of the avatar? And Swami says, rapid communication and transportation are largely responsible. In olden days, to move from Puttaparthi to Whitefield, that's about 120 miles, would be like a trip to a foreign continent. Now Americans come here from the other side of the world in just a few hours' time. I found this very, very interesting, Prem, because just before this, Swami is speaking about how the avatar can do anything that the avatar wishes, but there is a way it is done, and you know, it is not done to achieve spectacular things. It is meant to achieve permanent things. Immediately following that, Swami here is, you know, when you read that, you almost feel that, hey, there's nothing that I can do about. It's all in God's hands. Whatever God wishes, He'll do. But immediately after that, Swami is, I think it's divine humility, you know, to acknowledge saying that, no, it's not the will of the avatar. It's not as if Rama willed that enough people should not get to know me. It's not that Krishna willed that people should not get to know me. And it's not that I have specially willed that more people should get to know me. Swami says it's because of rapid communication and transportation. You know, it seems like a very, in our terms, practical answer. But going deeper, I just felt this is Swami's way of acknowledging human effort. All said and done, the communication improvement today, transportation improvement today is because of advances in science and technology, which for which man has put in a lot of effort. And it only shows that any and every effort counts. It is not as if this was not done by a devotee, so it won't count. Not like that. Any effort that is done, and because of that effort, you are able to come easier to me, and Swami is more well known across the globe. So, on one hand, I felt this is the divine humility being shown. On the other hand, I felt Swami is acknowledging efforts and stating that, yes, any and every effort will count. So, don't stop making efforts. Don't think that, you know, don't get into that doomsday kind of, not doomsday, what is that? There's a term for that. You get into a
fatalistic
mentality. Don't get into a fatalistic mentality that everything is predestined, nothing I can do can change anything. No, efforts matter. And yes, now more devotees are coming simply because of the improvement in communication and technology.
Right. And again, that idea that it finally comes down to your choice. You know, the very fact that, you know, you can listen to Swami's voice anytime that you want. Right. That is a luxury which is Swami's will, as well as Swami is saying here, scientific advancement that is born out of human effort. But even though it is available, now it is up to my choice, you know, whether I use that same technology and that grace of God to really tune into Swami's voice, or which I don't do most of the time, right? Mm-hmm. It finally comes down to what you want to do with that. So I think, as you rightly said, always there is an aspect of Swami's grace, there is an aspect of human effort and human advancement which has made even Swami's grace in certain ways accessible to us. But finally, how much of that are you going to use? You know, the sun is shining, but are we going and standing out finally matters.
In other words, there's an app ready on your phone, a press of which you can hear God's voice. But do I hear God's voice, right, or watch movies?
And even after downloading the app, is it just sitting there? Like, it happens. I think this is not to point out at anybody. Even for us, you know, 24 hours a day, are we completely in tune with Swami in that way? It comes down to spiritual transformation and how ready each one of us are.
Then that MG asks, will the university be here? Meaning in Bangalore. And Swami says, no, in Puttaparthi only. The college and others will remain as colleges. And to this day, that's how it is. The university is at Puttaparthi and Brindavan, Anantapur, and the Mudanalli campus. They are the three colleges that are there. Now Hislop continues. He says, Swami, may Kasturi publish Swami's talk to the Jews? I think so. Therefore, it must have happened in Brindavan only.
Right.
And Swami says, why? I said words that were just heart to heart. It was meant to be heart to heart and not for published in Sanatan Sarthi. So I think we will not find this in the Sanatan Sarthi. And again, it goes on to another topic. Hislop asks, is there enough milk from the Gokulam to provide to the college? Oh yes, Swami says, enough also for the canteens and residents in the compound. Some of the cows provide as much as 32 liters of milk a day. Hislop asks, how about the two cows at Prashanti Nilayam? Are they still good? Again, yet another proof that this is happening in Vrindavan. And Swami says, yes, the two cows from you and Mrs. Hislop. Still give more than 30 liters of milk a day. Now they have had 5 calves each. Very good cows.
Again, a very beautiful, simple conversation that happens. As I was saying, I think this must be before the Gokulam was established. So, I don't know. I think earlier some of the conversations appeared like it was in the later part of the 70s. So, this appears like it was in the earlier part of the 70s.
Or maybe that there is a Gokulam in Prashantilayam.
There's no mention of that as such.
And Hislop has just donated 2 cows.
Right, for possibly. That also could be one of the things.
Because I remember, you know, whenever we go to Gokulam, I don't know if the cow is still there, but they used to show one elderly cow saying, this is Swami's cow. So there was one cow who would give Swami milk, and blessed is that cow. I don't know if that cow is still there. When I had gone to Gokulam about 5-6 years back, one white, hefty, sturdy cow, white brownish kind of cow, you know, they used to, it had a separate enclosure for itself also, privileged cow, which would give milk to Swami. It was still alive by then. Now I don't know what has happened. So, so I think Hislop also must have provided 2 cows, and Swami saying, yeah, those cows are doing fine, don't worry, they have 5 calves.
And then this person, MG, continues to ask another question. He says, will the new university use computers?
So then this must be 1981 or 82, because the university is just coming up or it has just come up.
Right.
So definitely later.
So I think the idea of the university has already started. So at least the Prashantinilam campus must have already come. Mm. So I think that must be 78, 79. Mm. Then. So it is around that time. So Swami answers to that question. Swami says, no computers. The national exams were put on computers. It was a disaster. The many errors caused severe distress. Some students committed suicide. Afterwards, when the parents were told that the deceased students had really made high passing grades, much suffering resulted. The growing tendency to rely on computers and calculators to provide answers to problems is bringing about a rapid deterioration of intellect. In times past, people had to use their brains to think long and hard on problems. Now the mental work is handed over to a computer, and the mental faculties deteriorate through disuse. So this was Swami's answer about computers, and something that Swami has always maintained even later, even after the computers started being used, when we were students and all that, Swami would always say this, that the more you rely on all of these machines, you are putting lesser use to your own faculty. Some would say that leads to lesser self-confidence, and the rest of the things ensues after that. So this is something that Swami has always maintained, and in many ways you can see it with us. You know, as a simple thing as the number of phone numbers we would remember as children, we don't remember as many now, thanks to the phones which record everything. Even the simple mental arithmetics that we used to do as children, I think we struggle now. Children of our age struggle because you don't need to do that anymore.
No, forget remembering phone numbers. If I tell you that, you know, here are 3 numbers, Prem. One is Arvind's, one is Bishu's, one is Sai Prakash. Which is which? You won't be able to, because you have no idea also of how it ends, how it begins,
right.
Nothing, because it's just a name now. And this is very interesting because, you know, next MG asks, but is it not possible to use computers in a constructive and beneficial way? And Swami says, yes, this is going on. There is the intention to use them in ways that are beneficial and constructive. The immediate results appear to be very good. But in the long run, the use of computers and calculators will result in severe deterioration of human intellectual power. So Swami is saying, I am not saying that there are no benefits. There are benefits. For example, you know, when I look at the other revolution that happened, the first industrial revolution when physical labor got replaced with machines. You know, computer is replacing mental labor. But when that has happened, today when I compare myself to a farmer who is poor, most of the farmers in India are poor, other than commercialized farmers who are owning the land, who don't do any farming, but they just employ people to farm.
Mm-hmm.
So normal farmers who are actually working on the field, they are mostly poor. I'm sure they are not able to afford a kind of nutrition and diet that I can afford. And yet, almost every farmer will be healthier than me, simply because of the physical work they do in the field. So, at home now, I have a washing machine that washes, not yet got a dishwasher. In fact, on the days when in the lockdown, when the maid said that she, I mean, we, for the safety sake, we told the maid not to come for a few days, that is. When we had to do the house chores ourselves, I realized how difficult it is. And based on that, I just said, you know, sealing on desires means having a house only of that size which you can sweep and mop on a daily basis. You know, so it was so difficult. We have become so unused to physical labor. And that has shown on our health. You may say that, yeah, I am more productive, I am able to, I am richer in my wealth, I am having a better house. Yes, all that is fine, but your physical health has deteriorated. In fact, every day I need to do a walk, I need to go to the gym, I need to pay money, I need to do stuff to keep myself physically fit. When you see none of those farmers do any of that. They don't set out on walks, they don't do jogging, they don't do treadmill, they don't do power yoga, they don't do aerobics, they have not got any membership in any gym, and yet they are so fit, so strong. And I think that is what Swami is referring to in a mental sense also will happen. In times to come, yes, you outsource all your intellectual activity to the computer, your efficiency will increase, your cost will reduce, you'll become richer, but your mental capacity will go down just as your physical capacity has gone down, and then you will have to, just like now you are doing different things to maintain your physical health, you will have to indulge in quotes, recreation and other activities daily. I have to do this 1 hour to maintain my memory power. I have to do this for 1 hour to maintain my analytical reasoning power. I think a time will come like that very soon. And it's very clear that Swami is not saying that computers are bad in the sense that they don't give improvements. But Swami is saying that just the very fact that you use the computer, it's not about how it is being used. Usage itself deteriorates your creative and mental faculties.
Right, and one way of probably looking at it is, I was reading this very beautiful book, I think it's very popular right now, Sapiens, I forgot the name of the author, it's a book that a lot of people make references to, where he speaks about the early man, Neanderthals, and how Homo sapiens came to be. So he was saying that intelligence-wise, probably the man today, you can say, is more intelligent than his counterpart a few thousand years ago. But skills-wise, we are no comparison to them at all.
Oh.
Because if you had to be a survivor at that time, you had to know a lot more things than what you know today. You mean, if you're left in the wild, can you and I even build a hut? Forget about building anything else. But a man of that time had to know how to build a hut, how to cross a river, how to make a boat, how to make a weapon, how to protect himself from a wild animal.
To grow crops,
to climb a tree. All of these had to be known, rock climbing and everything, right? Now we are in a state where there's a lot of division of labor. Somebody else does the security, somebody else does the cooking, somebody else takes care of some of the technical jobs. So in that sense, he says that there is a clear deterioration in the skills of an individual, right? And because of this demarcation. So that's something that is always seen. But maybe one thing which we can look back upon, and if there is a silver lining to what Swami is saying, it comes down to, much of this you don't have to spend a lot of time yourself, right? Because one thing that you see when you look at societies that become prosperous, it means that there is a certain amount of freeing up of time. If you find a society where survival itself is difficult, much of your time and energy goes in you providing for yourself and your family. So when you say a prosperous society, it means that there is a lot of free time in hand, or your other faculties are being freed up for you to use. Hmm. So it comes down to what are you going to use them with?
Again, choice.
You know, when you're talking of your intellectual abilities being underutilized, or your creative abilities being underutilized, the question comes, what are you going to use your buddhi or discrimination and intellect for? So if you're able to use it for the right kind of things, this becomes a boon. This becomes a means by which you don't have to worry about all of these small things of mundane existence, and you can think of higher things, or you kind of miss that opportunity to utilize this mind space for something else more profound.
And with that, there's one just little section I think we will read through that. Nothing much to discuss there. We'll read through that and conclude. Hislop says, Swamiji, a personal question. Is December 9th the correct day for our departure, or would another date be better? Swami says, December 9th is the correct date. It's a good day. And then he says, Dr. S. I'm assuming it might be Samuel Sandweiss.
Okay.
I don't know.
Right.
He says, Dr. S wants to publish Swami's Christmas Day talks. Swami says, go ahead. He may do that. And then Hislop says, the translations are those of Mr. Kasturi, which he showed once to Swami. I have carefully read every word. Swami says, it's all right. Now MG says, Swami on Wednesday, the Jewish festival of light starts and continues for 8 days. Could the Jewish devotees have the lights burning here at Vrindavan? And Swami says, oh yes, they may do so. Where, Swami? And Swami says, under the central tree in the compound. Would Swami light the first lamp in the evening? And Swami says, yes, I will do that. So, looks like this MG is possibly a representative of the Jewish group also, or may not be, but either that or one of the members of the international organization. But he requests Swami that with the Jewish Festival of Lights, can we light? Swami says, yes, go ahead, no problem. And we have seen this happening even in the later years, I'm saying 2005, 2006, when we said from the hostel side that, Swami, we would like to celebrate Ramzan in the Mandir or Christmas, Holy Friday, Good Friday. You know, I remember one Good Friday was also the Indian Festival of Holi. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to put up a program called Holy Friday because, you know, it's Holy and Good Friday. Swami said, yes, go ahead. So anything that is about harmonizing, celebrating and coming together and spreading love, Swami always says yes. And here when they say that Jewish Festival of Light starts, so can we light lamps? Swami says, yes, go ahead, light. And Swami, will you light the first lamp? He says, yes, I will light it. So with that, dear listeners, we will come to the end of today's satsang. We will continue this conversation the next week as well. In the meanwhile, enjoy this song, on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment Love to Love. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
దాల్చిన దైవమా సాయి దైవమా దయకు ప్రేమకు రూపు దాల్చిన దైవమా సాయి దైవమా దిక్కులేని దీన జనుల బ్రోవ వచ్చిన దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా దయకు ప్రేమకు రూపు దాల్చిన దైవమా సాయి దైవమా కరువై గుండె బరువై దిక్కు తోచక దరిని చేరే ప్రేమ కరువై గుండె బరువై దిక్కు తోచక దరిని చేరే కల్లివై మరి తండ్రివై ప్రేమ చూపిన దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా దయకు ప్రేమకు రూపు దాల్చిన దైవమా సాయి దైవమా पतित पावन पापनाशक सत्य लोकवासी साई दैवमा करुण चिलिकी कैवल्यमोसगे साई रूपा दैवमा ना दैवमा साई दैवमा ना दैवमा साई दैवमा दयकु प्रेमकु रूपु दाचिन दैवमा साई दैवमा దిక్కులేని దీన జనుల బ్రోవవచిన దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా నా దైవమా సాయి దైవమా దయకు ప్రేమకు రూపు దాచిన దైవమా సాయి దైవమా